This morning, I'm going to talk about unexpected turns in our life. And so unexpected turns when life, you know, throws us a lemon. What do we do with it? If life throws us a curveball, you know, how do we hit it? And that kind of thing. And so, in other words, there are certain things in your life you have expectations of. You've thought to yourself, this is going to work out this way. And then sometimes you get up to the bat, so to speak. You get up to that place where you thought these things were going to go this way, and it doesn't go that way at all, right? You thought, for instance, when I had envisioned having four kids, like my wife and I actually talked about this years ago, 7, 8 years ago. We thought about having four kids, and we were like, we should have four kids. It'll be fun, you know, it'll be easy. And so in my head, I had this idea of what it would look like going to Disney World with four kids. This would be a blast because they're all 10. They all come out like 10 years old, and they're just super excited about everything. And then they just stay 10. I mean, there is no up or down. It's just, and then I had the unexpected turn of reality when we started having kids, and I didn't sleep at all for about 6 years. And then Alyssa really didn't sleep at all. And then vacation was a lot different than I had expected, right? So vacation was, I thought, oh, it's going to be a blast, can't wait to get there. But what I found out, vacation was this, when you have little kids who are like under 3, is that you put your kids in the car, you put your luggage in the car, you put your wife in the car, and then on that walk from putting your wife in the car into your driver's seat, that is your vacation when you have little kids. And so that's it, you know, and the rest of it's a lot of screaming and yelling and trying to keep them happy with everything that you can do. And so my expectation did not meet reality yet, but it's get there. So what do you do with that, though? What do you do with that? So life has a way of throwing you little and big curveballs, little and big unexpected, unwelcome changes and results. Funny ones would be, or not just funny ones, but like in your work this week, you probably had some. You thought your day would go different, and it didn't go the way you planned. You thought you'd get more studying done, but you didn't. You're still behind. You thought when you talked to your family on the phone, it would have been better. And maybe that's a daily example, but maybe there's physical examples, right? So, like, the older I get, the more I realize I have knees. It's weird. Like, I didn't realize I had knees until the last few years. And then I went and worked out about, it's been 2 or 3 years since I worked out, and I worked out about 2 weeks ago, and it took me literally 2 weeks to recover. I was like, what is wrong with me? And then I looked up some stats online, and apparently when you hit your 30s, you can only do about 90% of the bench press that you could normally do. So I could only do 400 as opposed to 450 or whatever, 440, whatever it was. So anyways, no, but And maybe you have unexpected changes. Like, you don't expect your knees to actually hurt eventually. Maybe you expected yourself to have more hair at this point in your life. Maybe you expected that you'd have a different pant size. Maybe you expected with friends, you know, and this is like more serious examples of things that turned and went different. But you find yourself growing apart from some friends that you thought you would be lifelong friends with. And things are changing and you're not sure what's going on. Or, you know, school examples, maybe you find yourself in a degree and you're starting to wonder, is that really the thing? Is this really what I'm supposed to do? I don't really like this. Maybe I need to take a change. This is not going how I expected. Or big curveballs, like you lost somebody who was very close to you. You didn't expect for that to happen. You thought your relationship status would be different at this point in your life. You didn't think you'd go through these hardships in all kinds of relationships, whether that was a marriage hardship, or you're having a hardship now with, you know, your spouse. Because sometimes you expect, you know, maybe your spouse will be a little bit further along in their humility and their love for you, and you're connecting with them than you had anticipated. And it's not turning out the way you thought. Life has thrown you a curveball, and you're sort of living in that. And so what do you do with these sort of unexpected turns in jobs and careers and families and relationships? How are we supposed to handle them? And these types of curveballs come. They do come. And if you haven't had one yet, a big one, unfortunately, it's on its way, okay? It's like that asteroid that's supposed to hit Earth millions of years from now and destroy all life. Thankfully, we won't live to see that. And Jesus will come back. I mean, it's a complicated thing. I'm not sure Anyway, I don't want to get into that. Okay, heavens and earth coming together. Is there still asteroids? I don't know. Anyways, all right. So with the big ones that come, what do you do about that? And so perhaps this problem is consuming more of your mental energy than you desire, more of your emotional capacity. It's affecting your social life. You find yourself thinking about this problem in your life, this unexpected turn and how to deal with it, and you don't want to think about it anymore. And you find it draining in some way, and you find it affecting others around you. You can't help but, I don't know if there's any other word I can, word vomit on people about your problems when it's going on. And you can't help but talk about it all the time, and you feel like you're draining those people. Like, what do I do? So what do you do with these curveballs? Well, thankfully, we're not the first person to deal with an unexpected change of events. What we'll look at this morning, is Mark, where am I? Mark chapter 9. And in this chapter, and in these verses 14 through 29, what we see is that a couple of unexpected things happen. After Jesus is, he gets on the Mount of Transfiguration, he transfigures before his disciples. Right after that, noticeably in Mark, the disciples' lives become a lot harder. And things stop working the way they had expected. And not only for them, but they encounter a dad. One of the first people they encounter right after the transfiguration is this father. And this father has had, you know, a little boy, and I'm sure he was happy like every dad would be to have a son, and he's excited. But this boy, for years and years and years, has had chronic seizures under the influence of a demon. And the father, of course, is like, what do I do about this? I didn't expect this would happen in my life. And so he's been dealing with this unexpected turn for years, whereas the disciples are just coming to an unexpected turn for the first time, especially in regards to their job and to their ministry. And so whether you're in a chronic situation where you're like, it's been years where this thing I thought would change isn't changing, or it's this new thing that's happening, this passage hopefully will help us understand how to navigate these things. So let's look this morning at Mark chapter 9. As we see how Jesus deals with these unexpected turns, and how maybe he can help, how he can show us how we can deal with ours. So Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 29. And I have a PowerPoint this morning, which is something I normally don't do. So there you go. Look at this. All right, you guys ready? So I'm just going to read it and try to. So this is where some of you guys fall asleep. It's okay with me. Okay? But this is the Word of God, right? This is God speaking to us. So this would be a great time to pay attention, all right? So let's check it out. So Mark chapter 9, verses 14 through 18. The four of them, who's that talking about? It's talking about Jesus and the three disciples that he brought up to the Mount Transfiguration, made their way back to the other disciples, the nine disciples who were left in a town. And the four disciples saw, along with Jesus, a large crowd surrounding the nine and legal experts arguing with the nine disciples. And as soon as the crowd saw Jesus, they saw him coming in, the crowd was astounded, and they all ran up to greet him along with the disciples. And then Jesus asked, what's all the fuss about? Okay, that's a little different translation. I just appreciated that. I read that. I was like, I like that, okay? But he's like, what's going on here? So what's all the fuss about, he asked. And he's asking the nine disciples, really. And then out of nowhere, says from the crowd, teacher, said someone from the crowd, I brought my son to you. He's got a spirit that stops him from speaking. Notice the pathos here. Immediately, right? What's the arguing about? The dad raises his hands. I don't care about all this arguing. What I need is my son to be healed. You feel that? And that is such an appropriate thing to bring to Jesus, isn't it? Because he doesn't just give us doctrines and beliefs for just the sake of having these intellectual discussions, but he wants those to actually dive into those beliefs and the things he's teaching to actually come and be a part of our lives and change us. And so he's the perfect person to ask, tell this to. Look, they're arguing about all kinds of stuff, but I need this. I brought my son to you. He's got a spirit that stops him from speaking. And you can imagine the sorrow in the father's heart as he's talking about his son. Whenever it takes hold of him, it throws him on the ground. He foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth, and he goes stiff. And I spoke to your disciples about casting it out, but they couldn't. So just leave it right there for right now. Right there, what do you think your response would be? Now, if you're like me, I'm a practitioner. Like, I want to I want to solve the problem immediately. Like if I get a text message, it's hard for me not to respond right then and there, partly because if I don't, you may not get that response for days and weeks to come, right? And so I like to respond immediately. And that's what we might expect Jesus to do with this son situation. Bring him to me. I'll heal him right now. But Jesus doesn't. Let's see what he says. This is Jesus' response to what the father said. Next slide. He said, "You unbelieving generation." That seems really harsh, doesn't it? We'll talk about why that is in a second. But, "You unbelieving generation," replied Jesus, "how much longer must I be with you?" So he's not just talking to the dad. He's talking to the whole crowd. He's talking to the disciples, as we'll see in a second. And we'll have to come back to this in a little bit. But the disciples tried to cast out this demon of this little boy without praying. Like, that's where it ends. Jesus says, if you had prayed, the demon would have come out. But you didn't. Because their faith is not in God. It's in maybe their own ability, you see. So he says to everybody, "You unbelieving generation," replied Jesus, "how much longer must I be with you? How much longer must I put up with you? Bring the boy to me." And so the next verse is, and so the boy was brought to him. He brought him to the boy. And when the spirit saw Jesus, it immediately threw the boy into a convulsion. And he fell on the ground. And right before Jesus, he was rolled about, foaming at the mouth. So you can imagine the dust. You can imagine the motion, the commotion, and the crowd. It's happening again. What do we expect Jesus to do? What would you do? If you got the power to heal, what would you do? You'd immediately heal the external problem, wouldn't you? Right? I would. Anyone else in here with me? Seems like the right thing to do. What does Jesus do? He starts a conversation with the dad in the midst of this. Because this shows he will not be hurried. He will not be rushed. He will not be moved to do what you want him to do immediately. He's trying to do something deeper. And it's the same thing with your external problems, as we'll see in a second. So what does he do? He says, "Look, how long has it been like this with the child?" asked Jesus. "Since childhood," replied the man. "Often it even throws him into the fire or water to kill him. But if you can do anything, please, please help us. Have compassion on us. Have pity on us." "If you can," said Jesus, "everything is possible to someone who believes." And this the father exclaimed, "I do believe," but he doesn't leave it there. "Help me in my unbelief." In the next slide. Jesus saw that the crowd was getting bigger by the minute. He scolded the unclean spirit, speechless and deaf spirit. He said, "I command you, come out of him and never go back again." And the spirit yelled, gave the boy a huge convulsion, and he came out. And the boy seemed to be dead. In fact, several people said, "He's dead. The boy's dead. He's gone." But, next verse, but Jesus took him up by the hand and helped him to his feet, and he stood up. And then the disciples later on, why couldn't we cast it out? Asked his disciples once they were back at the house by themselves. And he said, "This sort," replied Jesus, "can only come out by prayer." And there's another verse that parallels this one in Matthew. And it actually says, he says, "If you had just had faith," he said, "why didn't it come out? Why didn't the demon come out?" He says, "Had you just had faith as small as a mustard seed, it would have come out. You could move one mountain to there." They didn't even have faith as small as a mustard seed. That is why. They didn't have prayer. They had what Jesus was right about saying, faithlessness, which is really just faith in something else, isn't it? So let's look at, what does all this mean? Because there's a lot here to unpack. All right, so what's the whole passage about? Well, one thing, like I mentioned, is that Jesus won't be rushed. Because Jesus is after more than the external problems of our lives. He's after the internal workings of our life. He's after something deeper in each one of us. Jesus uses the external problem of the boy to highlight something in everyone who's there. To the root that he sees. He sees spiritually, right? He sees right into the heart of us all. And he says, "When I see into the heart of you all, I see faithlessness. I don't see faithfulness. I see a lack of faith." And that seems kind of harsh, but that's what a good doctor does, right? A good physician doesn't just rush in and start like cutting you up and just throwing stuff out. And it doesn't just take off of the symptoms. It wants to go after the root of this. And so this is just like every movie you've ever seen, right? See, every movie you've ever seen has an external problem. This is how every single movie starts. Now, whether that's Liam Neeson needs to rescue his daughter, or that's Marlin needs to find his Nemo, okay? And so what is Marlin? Externally, Marlin finding Nemo is about what? Literally finding Nemo. I mean, it's as clear as it could be. What's the external problem in the movie? I gotta find my son Nemo. But what's the internal problem with him? Anybody know? Take a guess. What's that? Somebody say God? Yeah, I guess so, sure. What's that? Doubt. Yeah, he's scared, you remember? Because his wife, remember that whole scene at the beginning? And then he's scared. And so the question is, will he overcome his fears? And not just overcome his fears in a little way for his son, but literally swim across the whole ocean. And that external thing that's going on is pointing toward an internal problem. And so too, Jesus is saying over and over again, your external problems are just my way of bringing up something that's deeper rooted, that's internal. And he wants to work on that. So you say, I'm having a tough week. My job's not going the way I thought. My friendships aren't going the way I'd hoped. I've got relationship issues left and right. Or I've got one here, I've got one there. I've got something that's not working in my life, whatever that is right now for you. And it's taking all kinds of mental energy to continue to think about it. Maybe you wake up thinking about it. When you're in your solitude, it consumes your thoughts. It's habitually there and just pops up over and over again. Or you find yourself talking about it incessantly. So whatever that is, you think, that's the problem. No, that's just the symptom of a deeper problem, is what Jesus would show. And so what is this deeper problem? Well, Jesus says it can be summed up like this: faithlessness. Oh, faithless generation. Now, this is really tough to see. And as I say it, it hurts to even believe that about yourself, right? Because you're Christians, and I believe, and I have faith. But look at the disciples. Look at what's going on in the scene. No one actually thinks that they're faithless, do they? See, faithlessness has a way of blinding us to it. And what does it mean? We'll get into what it means, what this problem actually means, what it means to have faith in a second. But I just want to put my finger on what Jesus is saying way deep down, what's going on in our hearts. Why we have anxiety, why we have stress, why we have these external problems. It's because of faithlessness. And everyone has it in this situation, in this scene, but no one sees it. And so that's a really scary problem to have. Because we're all going to think that it's someone outside of this room. Or maybe the person sitting beside us or something like that. But we won't think that it's us. It has a way of blinding us. And it blinded virtually everyone at this place, except for the Father. And that's only after Jesus put some pressure on it. And then he was like, you know what? I do have unbelief. He was the only one that admitted it. Right? And so it's hard for us to do that. It's hard for us to see that. So Jesus says that faithlessness is a big problem. So what is faithlessness? Why is this a big problem and the root of all problems? And what's the solution to this? Okay, you guys ready for those three? All right. Buckle up. All right. This is going to be a ride for the next 4 hours. Okay, so no, I'm just kidding. So what is faithlessness? In order to talk about faithlessness, we need to talk about what faith is. See, faithlessness, again, is not just having no faith in anything. Everybody has faith in something. And when I'm talking about faith this morning, I'm talking about faith not in the head, but faith in the heart. And that's the way the Bible talks about it, too. Hebrews 11:1. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for. What is hoping for something in that verse? The heart is hoping for something. It's the assurance of the heart that something, my voice just cracked, I think. It's the assurance of the heart that something is going to happen. Does that make sense? Faith is the assurance of the heart that something is going to happen. It's the conviction of the heart in something that's not seen. So we all have faith in something. See, the heart is hoping in the unseen, having a conviction about what will satisfy it. You have to understand the heart in order to understand faith. The heart is the seat of the affections. It's the seat of the desire. It's the seat of the most inner part of who we are. It's the seat of the mind, will, and emotions. Whatever's in the heart, you'll think about without trying to think about, you'll do without trying to do, and you'll feel without trying to feel. See, faith is not just a belief in an action. It's not just a belief in saying the heart, this will satisfy my heart. But it's such a strong belief at the heart level that you will just reach out to something and hold on to it for satisfaction in your heart. Your heart just can't help but reach out to stuff and grab onto it. To think about it another way, it's like the woman, the Canaanite woman, who grabs onto Jesus' cloak. Remember that? She has the issues of blood, and she sees Jesus, and she's like, that'll change me. And she grabs onto him. And so our hearts are constantly doing that in our life. This will satisfy my relationship issues. If I just start dating that guy, it'll satisfy my relationship issues. If I just get the job, it'll satisfy my sense of meaning. And our heart just grabs into the dark on something it thinks will actually satisfy it. That's faith. And you can have faith in all kinds of things. But that's faith at a heart level. And so what is your faith, what is your heart grabbing onto this morning for satisfaction at the deepest levels? And again, we already talked about how you can kind of identify that. It just comes up without trying. You think about it without trying. You feel it without trying to feel about it. You do without trying to do anything about it. It consumes your interior life. It consumes your solitude. You go home at night. And maybe you don't think about it there, but you deal with its dissatisfaction by, you know, I always mention this, but by turning on Netflix, right? That's a super common one these days. Or by getting on Instagram and looking at how happy everyone else's life is, you know? And so I love how those pictures on Instagram, this super side note here, sort of a bee in my bonnet. I just wish we could do like a real gram, not like an Instagram. Like, what's life really like? Like when you're trying to take pictures with four kids, it's like crazy chaotic. It's not like everybody's smiling throughout our whole day. Like, this has just been so much fun. It's like people screaming, you know, there's all kinds of human stuff everywhere, you know, that people produce. It's not like those pictures, you know? And so anyways, all right. So total side note. But going back to it, the disciples have faith in something other than Jesus. Yes, they're faithless in the right place, but they have faith in something else. They don't pray, which means they have faith in their own abilities. They're looking back and saying, I figured this thing out with God. If I do X, 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 this system, it will always produce that. I don't really need him anymore. I don't need to pray anymore. I can do these things and get results without him. Which is not faith in God, it's faith in a system God used at one time. And that's what the human heart constantly kind of wants to do. It wants to be its own Savior and Lord. And so after, over time, over and over again, it wants to get him out of the way and wants to step up and say, I figured it out. Now I can, in some ways, control my life without you in it. And the disciples we know are actually doing this because not only did they not pray and not see success here, but later on in the passage, they say this incredible thing. It's incredible. They just messed up. They just didn't heal the boy. And then four or five verses down, they start arguing about who's the greatest among them. Like, oh man, yeah, you didn't cast the demon out, but like, I really didn't cast the demon out. I mean, what are they even arguing about there, right? And so if we're supposed to look at these chapters, these sections as wholes, this shows a little window into the disciples' heart. The reason they wanted to cast the devil out themselves and not really rely on God is because they wanted to make a name for themselves. Just like the people of the Tower of Babel. They wanted to say, I'm the greatest. I know I'm somebody because I can do these things. And I'm sure that was part of what they were arguing about, right? That's part of the reason they were arguing. And so, what is your heart reaching out for in the dark in regards to approval, adoration, security, and comfort? Is it how people treat you at work today? How much money, what that number is when you look at your bank account? Is that where you go when times are tough? Well, but at least I've still got that. Or is it something else? What is it in your heart that you say, if only I get this one day, then I'll be happy? And Jesus wants to come in like the master surgeon that he is and pull that out and replace it with something totally different. Why does he want to do this, though? Why does he consider faithfulness such a big problem? Why does Jesus look to solve this problem? It's because of the longings of our heart. Because he knows what will satisfy and what won't. He knows that healing this boy today, unfortunately, it will help the father out. There's no doubt. But it will not satisfy the father's or the son's deepest longings. It won't satisfy the crowd's deepest longings to see another miracle. It won't satisfy the disciples' desires to be adored, to participate once again in healing somebody. He knows that. Because the heart is longing for something more. It's longing to satisfy. Our heart's longing for satisfaction of lifelong nostalgia. It's longing to be reunited with something in the universe from which we now feel cut off, to be on the inside of some door which we have always seen from the outside. At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door, but all the leaves of the the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor. It's him. It's happened. It's broken into our world what we're looking for. It's Jesus. So whatever we put our faith in to solve this problem will ultimately rule our hearts, and Jesus knows that. And it'll break our hearts and our hearts over and over again. Any external fix will only be temporary. For that boy who is having seizures as a result of demonic activity is often what's going on inside of us when we put our hearts on something other than Jesus, when we have faith in something other than Jesus, is that our, so to speak, our heart's teeth grind. We have anxiety in our hearts. Over time, our hearts begin to numb as we've thrown into the fires of the world over and over and over again. We stop to feel God's love or have hope for the future. So outwardly, we see that with the boy, but inwardly, that's going on with us when we have faith in anything other than God. So Jesus knows that without life found in him, this will continue to happen. So not only are what are you holding on to, but what is holding on to you? One way to tell is what your conversations are filled with. Are you like the father who puts his faith in Jesus, but not in past results? You know, that's the one thing that's going on here too, is the father is not just putting his, he eventually puts his faith in Jesus, but initially, what's he do? He almost says, like, if you can do this, I don't know if you can. Because his faith is not in what God can do. His faith really is in the past results. And often this is how we live our life. We get to a place of hopelessness in our life. Like, God hasn't done it. I haven't seen it happen in years and years and years. And so therefore, he can't actually do it. He can't solve the problem. And we think about this going forward with God too. And we're not supposed to have faith in what's the experience of God. We're supposed to have faith in his words and him. So that's what's going on. That's the problem. The solution to faithlessness is a growing faith in him alone. There's this common idea. Well, let me say this. What God wants to do with growing your faith is to have your heart grab onto Jesus. And when you become a Christian, you have what's called salvific faith, right? It's in Ephesians 4:2 says that God gives you that as a gift. Like Jesus is knocking at the door. You guys know that analogy, right? And then we open the door. The reason we open the door, as Ephesians 4:2 says, the gift of God. God has given us a gift of faith to open the door, to believe what he's saying is true. You see? And so that happens. And then when he comes in, it's like he comes into the foyer, and now he's at the inside your house. And what he wants to do is he wants to be a part of every room. He wants to go in every door. He wants to go in every place. He wants to go in your kitchen, in your living room, in your every single part. He wants to go into the parts of your heart that crave approval. He wants to go in the hearts of your part that crave security. He wants to go into the hearts of your part. Hang on. The parts of your heart. We had a long week on campus, okay? Yeah. The hearts of your part. Yeah. I'm going to just put that under that. Okay, the parts of your heart that crave approval and security and comfort. He wants to work his way in through every room. And so often what happens in the Christian faith, and the scriptures speak to this about shipwrecking your faith, is that Jesus has now come into the foyer, and that's as far as he's ever gone. Or maybe for a while you let him into more of your life, you let him into the living room of your life, but now that's it. And so you're supposed to be growing and growing and growing into more and more faith and letting Jesus into every room. But often what we do is we just let him into the first few, and then we feel pretty good about ourselves, and then we call it quits. And the way you know you're letting him into more and more of your heart is that it says in 2 Thessalonians, as your faith grows, so will your love for Christians grow. So is your love for Christians growing? Do you find yourself having a less censorious, judgmental spirit towards weak Christians, those who fail or those who are self-deceived? Have you been cold to anyone lately? You see, as your faith grows, you become more warm, you become more loving towards the people around you. Love can't help but follow faith. Is that happening for you? I know in a lot of my areas it's probably not. I'm cold to some people and maybe warm to others. What about you? So, how do we actually grow? That's the solution, is growing. How do we do it? One, you have to recognize your level of faithlessness. This is tough to do. this is really tough to do. Because when we think about growing in faith, what we often think about is mustering up enough thought material to believe something, right? That's what you do. Like, I'm going to believe this computer is going to move from here to there, and that's God's will, right? And that's what we try to do. We summon up enough, like, mental thought. But this isn't talking about mental faith. It's talking about heart faith. It's talking about the deep recesses of your heart, and what it believes will solve its deepest problems. So how do you do that? As one commentarian said, religion starts by saying, look, this is how you grow your faith. Look, I'm holy. I believe you so much. I really summoned up all my faith. I've gotten rid of all my doubts. Now you have to work in my life. Ever heard of that? It's not that. Because that often is, you know what that often is? It's often a faith in your ability to come up with faith, to produce faith yourself. And we know faith is a gift from God that we got in salvation. And what Galatians says is that having begun in the Spirit, are you trying to be perfected in the flesh? Having begun, God giving you a gift of faith, are you now trying to make faith yourself? Or are you turning to Him and saying, I don't have faith, but I know that you give it. And going to Him over and over again, give me more faith. Give me more. I don't believe like I should. And admitting that. So it starts with admitting where you actually are. Like, God, I actually don't think that this whole singleness thing, right, that's supposed to satisfy, you're like my husband and you're supposed to satisfy me. I don't know if I actually believe that. That's an honest assessment. But I want to believe that in my heart. God, can you give me faith for that? Can you help me with that? I don't actually believe that you're the Father in my life that I need, and all I need is you. I don't actually believe that. I want to believe that. I know I should. Can you give me faith, God? Give me the gift of faith to believe that too. It starts with an honest assessment of reality, and then it moves to an honest assessment of what the Scriptures say He will do. And that's that He says He will give faith to those who've asked. And so finally, the third thing that we do in order to grow in our faith is recognize our level of faithlessness. Ask God, realize the gift of faith, and that you can ask for it, and you can grow in a measure of it by asking God for it. The third thing to do is be actually desperate for it. The Father here cries out in desperation, doesn't He? Help me with my unbelief. I believe, but help me with my unbelief. It's a real heart-filled desire. It's genuine. He's not making it up. He isn't contriving it. He's saying, I really have this problem. I really need this problem of my boy fixed. I realize what you're saying about how this faith isn't deep enough, that my belief in you isn't deep enough. Help me with that. And so faithfulness, having faith, is just growing from I can do it to only He can do it. I can solve my heart problems to really only He can. And the same way you came into the faith is the same way in which you continue to grow the rest of your life. You don't come into Christ by faith and by grace. And then, if you want to grow, just try really hard from now on and good luck. God's a Father who holds you by the hand all the way through. And if you'll go to Him and ask in desperation, please help me. Please, I really need this. I'm really starting to realize that I don't believe fully that you are enough in this area, that you really are my security. What I really believe is if I have enough money in my bank account. You see? And crying out in desperation. Now that brings us to our last question, which is this. God will give faith, and you need to grow through faith, and you can ask for it. But the question is, will He actually give it to you if you ask for it? Will He give you faith? Can He give you faith? Will He give you faith? It's, you know, similar. And the Father cries out a similar question. He says, can you do it? And He says, yeah, of course. He says, will you have compassion on me? Jesus is like, of course I'll have compassion on you. Yes, I can heal your external problems, but I'm really after the internal one. And so when we cry out for faith for God to not just heal our external problems, but begin to help our heart believe that He is all that we need, we might find ourselves questioning whether if we cry out for faith, He will give it, if He can give it. Maybe we believe He can, but we're not sure if He will. And so this goes back to that story about the Father. And this story about a father or a parent having a child comes up over and over again in the Gospels, doesn't it? Over and over again, you have a kid who's possessed, a kid who's under warfare, a kid, and the mom and dad's like, please do something about this. What is this supposed to remind us of? Are we perhaps supposed to see these stories as a reflection of a grieving love of a father for his child, maybe Israel, for his image-bearing daughters and sons throughout the world, probably, but also for his unique son, Jesus himself, as he goes obediently, mute before his captors, to a certain death. At the very heart of the story, Jesus the Father, Jesus says, yes, of course I'm going to have compassion on you. I'm going to restore what's going on in your son. I'm going to take these infirmities away from him. Yeah, of course I am. I'm going to have compassion. And the reason Jesus is able to have compassion on this father and son is because on the cross, he's not given such a compassion. That same compassion that's afforded to this father and son are not afforded to the father and son on the cross. You see, his answer is absolutely, I can and I will give you faith. And I will resolve your problems, and I will heal you internally, and I will eventually one day wipe out all this external stuff too. And even now, some of that's happening. But I promise I'll do it. I promise I'll have compassion. Because on the cross, he ultimately gets what we deserve. He gets no compassion at all. He gets no quarter at all. And he does this for you. And in that story of the father and the son, I can't imagine the father, or like just say, I can't imagine myself, giving up his son like that for anybody. Letting his son be thrown into something like that to save someone else. Letting his son be thrown into the fire again and again. And yet on the cross, this is exactly what we see, is the son being thrown into the fire of hell for us. Don't we? Because that's how far and wide and willing he is to go to get you back. And to heal all your infirmities. On the cross, he is mute to God's love. He doesn't hear. He can't speak to God. He's deaf to God's love. He can't hear it. So you can always hear his pardoning voice. So you can always hear the whisper in your heart, I love you, son or daughter. As Romans 8 says, Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are sons and daughters, because on the cross it did not bear that witness to Jesus, so it could forever bear that witness to you. So when you ask the question, can he, will he give me faith, will he resolve the real deep internal problems that are consuming my life? Yes, he will. Turn to him. And he'll change everything. 2 Timothy 2:13, I want to end on this. It says, when we are faithless, he remains faithful, for he cannot deny himself. How good an assurance is that, is even when you don't have faith in him and you have faith in all these other things, when you've only let him into the foyer of your life, or you've let him into the living room but not the other places, he is still faithful. He is still working things out for your good. He is still caring for you. He is still making you shine, making you become the person you were made to be. And he's working that out until the end. And so as we sing this verse, I think we should just all, you know, as we're going to sing these words this morning, this idea of God, give me faith for something specific in my life, to believe, to trust what you say. Give me faith to believe in you, to shift my belief from the things in my life and those external problems being taken care of to having deep-seated satisfaction in you. Give me that faith to do that. I'm not doing that in this area. Help me start doing it in that specific area. Does that make sense? All right, well, let's all stand and worship and thank God for all that he's given us. Jesus, I just thank you this morning for all of this, for your love for each one of us. While we were sinners, you died for us. That you were thrown into the pit of despair so that we could have the hope and joy of the gospel. God, there are people in this room this morning, including myself, that there's areas, big areas in our life that make us unkind to people at times, that make us judgmental, that make us anxious, that make us faithless in you and faithful in our own abilities. And God, I just pray you would reveal that in all of our hearts. You would do the work that you often do as the good doctor who comes in and cuts out the internal, put in a new heart, to grow what you have already started doing within. So we just pray that you'd come more into our heart this morning, and you'd help us believe less in ourselves and our abilities and more in you and your ability to give us faith to believe in your good news and what you've done for us on the cross. In Jesus' name, amen. God, thank you that you give us faith to trust what you say, to believe that you are great, that you love us, God, this week as we go through unexpected turns. I pray that we wouldn't try to solve the problem. We wouldn't try to fix the problem immediately. But we would use it as a way to lean more on you. To ask you to give us faith to believe that you are enough. To admit that we don't have faith like we ought to. And reach out to you and say, Lord, please give us faith to believe. And that we would grow, our hearts would grow in its faith for you. And as that result, Lord, we pray that love would just sort of wash over every part of our life, all of our coworkers, all of our friends, as a natural result of you changing us. Give us faith, Lord, this week to trust what you say. In Jesus' name, amen.